What's the next step once you've acquired the data? And then talking about some of the future plans we have in our group to proceed with these kinds of automation ideas, and perhaps get a little philosophical near the end about what my personal opinion is about and where all of this is going. So obviously, collecting the data is really important, and as Clint explained, we've automated that as much as we can, and we can collect enormous amounts of data. But what we really want is the map. So it makes perfect sense to us to try and integrate our automated data collection with our subsequent processing and reconstruction packages. And you've heard this from many of the people who spoke earlier in the week, you know, Joachim and various others. You know, what are the steps in processing and reconstructing? And it's in assessing the images, determining the CTF, selecting and segmenting particles, and doing the actual reconstruction. And I'll go through some of those and tell you what our approaches have been in all of this, in getting all of this done. I mean, ultimately, as Tim said, what we want is a big green go button with lots of, you know, intermediate results coming out that you can page through and look and assess and all the rest of it. But you shouldn't be sitting there tippity-tippity typing, you know, this, that, and the other. I mean, all of that, in the end, we hope, will be a streamlined, high-throughput pipeline. So assessing the data, I mean, the most important tool for us in assessing this data is our database. And I hope live demos are always a problem, but let's see if we can pull this off. So every single experiment we've ever run using Legilon, and I think there's hundreds of them now, are stored in our Legilon database. And so here's the list of them. I'm going to show you a particular one because we own it, and then I won't be showing somebody else's data off. So here's a particular TMV experiment that we did, and if you ask for a report on the experiment, we'll tell you about when we started and ended and some details about how many grid squares were visited and how many holes, etc. And then there'll be a whole shopping list of comments made by the operators as the experiment went on. So we can go and look back and see, well, what did happen at square number 9? You know, how come the data looks so bad there? And we might get a comment that, you know, the stage started drifting or whatever it is. So we keep track of all our experiments this way. We can also look at any of the images from any of these experiments. We keep every single image in the database. And let's go back down to that same experiment, which is way down here somewhere, March 12th. So as Clint points out, we have an atlas of the whole grid, so we can look at the whole grid. We can also go and see what we selected off that grid. Hopefully you can all see very faintly. These are the actual grid squares that we visited that we deemed good enough to go and take an image of the square and make some more decisions on. So we can look at those. We can go and look at those squares. Here we go. And see where we targeted on the square. We always have them in reverse order first. So the last few are always terrible because that's when everything was shutting down and nobody could be bothered anymore. So this is some of the images at the beginning. You know, there's the image of the square. It shows you which holes were selected by the system. We can then go and look at each of those holes and the targets on them. Here we go, holes and targets. Again, things going south near the end of the experiment. Here's a typical hole. Here's another one. So on that hole, we imaged 4 targets. And maybe I'll explain a little bit later why we do this sort of 4 target imaging rather than just a single image. So we can look at those. Finally, we do the focusing, so we can go and look at the focus image, or more usefully, look at the Fourier transform of the focus image and see how well it's focused, you know, whether there was astigmatism, that sort of thing. We're just browsing these images at the moment, although some of this can also be automated to automatically alert you if something is going wrong with this. And then finally, we'd acquire the exposure images, and I'm going to show you the second exposure because, as pointed out, the contrast in that image is much better. So we can actually see what's going on. You can't see what's going on, but there are actually TMV filaments going along in here. Or we could look at the exposure 1, the first image with very low dose. But more usefully for TMV, actually, we can look at the Fourier transform of that exposure image. And we connect those into the database as well. And this, you probably can't see it all from the back, so we'll look at it at full size. Loads up in a second. And if TMV is in a nice big packed array, you can actually see layer lines in this Fourier transform of the exposure 1 image. And you can see that's the 23 angstrom ley line, that's the 11 angstrom ley line. So you're sort of getting the feel that, okay, this experiment's working well and the dose is right and everything's going on. So we typically browse those images during an experiment. You can set it to a web browser at your desk and watch them coming in and, you know, flip around with them and all the rest of it. But it's just a browser. It's not a systematic analysis and it's not an automated analysis. What else? Let's close that. Oh, we also sometimes acquire a post-square image. You actually saw some of these in Clint's talk. And in that, you can actually see where you, unless I'm blocking it, where you focused when you were acquiring that hole, because you will be, because the dose goes way up in doing the focusing, especially if the thing is drifting and you're sitting there for a while, you'll have burnt a little hole in the ice. So we acquire all these images so that we can track what's going on, and also, as I'll explain a little bit further later on, so we can systematically analyze the experiment and try and figure out what makes a good image and what makes a bad image, because it's not always clear from the images themselves. And we have all kinds of views into this database. I showed you a very simple one. We also have a viewer where you can link all the images together. Let me just go to demo mode here and view it. And so basically, you can look at the HiNAG image associated with all the other images. And just get back to my favorite experiment here. So you're looking at this HiNAG image, which came from this square, which came from this hole, and you can figure out which target it is. And then you can browse through these images and track that throughout the whole experiment. And again, you're trying to get an idea, why was that image so good or so bad? You know, was it something about where it was on the square or where it came from the hole? Or, you know, and you can track the focus images at the same time. And this is a very useful way of learning how to do the job better. You know, if you end up with a set of bad images, you may not quite know why. But if you can look at the whole history of the experiment and track all those features at the same time, you may learn something. And this database, oh, by the way, it's going to be demos of all this automation tomorrow. Denny Salmon designed this database, and he's going to be sitting in the control room, and he can talk you through it and show you all kinds of different views into it and show you the new database that we're designing now. Jim, at the same time, will be actually doing a live Legendon run and acquiring image data from the microscope. And then various others I'll tell you a bit more as we go through the talk will also be showing off their stuff. Okay. So that's the database, and it's sort of our fundamental tool for examining all the data and keeping track of it. A typical experiment, as Clint said, is, you know, maybe 5 to 10,000 images, 20 gigabytes of data. So it's a lot of data because we don't throw anything away. We figure we can mine this database for information later. So we keep those squares and keep those holes. We've done about, this is probably a little bit out of date, but about 300 experiments. You know, it's keeping track of, you know, 1.5 terabytes of data or so. And that database has never crashed and has never been corrupted. Which is knock on wood, actually, at that point. But it's been very stable, and we still go back and look at data from several years ago. This whole archiving problem, of course, is a big issue. I mean, it's 1.5 terabytes of data. Not all of it is online, though. We do archive things off. There's an automated archive system that dumps that data onto a huge big backup system of scripts, and then we can delete it on our database if we like, but if we want it back, by simply clicking one button, we can download the entire data set back, and the database keeps track of where it comes back to. It doesn't have to go back to the same disk. It can go onto some other disk somewhere else. So you don't have to be so terribly careful about your disk management. Okay, so the database provides a means of systematically assessing the quality of the data, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. It also provides a system for delivering this data to other people in the community. There's plenty of people out there who would like to help write some algorithms for CryoEM and do some of the very hard image processing tasks we have. And part of their problem is they can't get access to cryo data. It's kind of hard to deliver that data annotated in a way that makes sense to them. And I'll talk a little bit more about that again later. Okay, I just had these up in case the live database demo didn't work. But basically we're collecting a first exposure and a second exposure. We can look at Fourier transforms of this. In the case of TMD, that's quite helpful because you can see the layer lines and you can see whether the data is good quality. We also collect the focus image from the low-dose position and its Fourier transform, which we're going to use to measure the defocus of the microscope. In the case of Broyel of single particles, you can see that the power spectrum of the image doesn't tell you much. In particular, what it doesn't tell you much of is the CTF. It's really hard to see a CTF ring there and to measure it. The image just simply isn't big enough and there's not enough protein in the image. It's very easy, of course, to do that measurement from the focus image. And that's what we've, in general, done. Okay, so that was the first thing, assessing the images. So now we'll go on to actually determining the defocus. And what order you do this in is, you know, fairly arbitrary, but at some stage you're going to do this. And this was the order that Joachim had it in, so I thought I'd stick to that. And you all know by now, you know, the CTF and, you know, at a small defocus, this first minimum is about 10 angstroms. At a high defocus, that first minimum is, well, I don't know, about 20 angstroms, and you've got many, many phase clips as you go out to high resolution data. That's why we like to take that very first image very close to focus, about 300 nanometer, because in as much as we have errors in determining our defocus, those errors will be much less severe if we're shifting, you know, a little bit of a zero here than if all of these are shifting and scrambling all the data as we add them together. So we like to work in this region even though the particles can be semi-invisible. Sure? No. I mean, we want these positions, right? I'm not talking about B factors and noise and backgrounds. I'm going to say a few words about that in a minute, but I mean, basically we're trying to find the position of these zeros. Let me think. I mean, that's a good point. I mean, generally we're looking at data 10 angstroms and under. And it's true that if we change this, this can move a fair amount, but probably all our data out to about 10 angstroms is going to be okay. Whereas if we get it a little bit wrong here, we'll probably have scrambled all of our data, you know, from 20 angstroms out. So that was the philosophy. But it's worth discussing some more. And basically doing the math to see exactly what does happen with small errors in each of these conditions. Okay, so that's what we want to do. We want to measure the defocus. I think you've heard in some of the practicals and in some of the lectures up to now, what some people do in measuring that defocus is to take an average of all the particles, an incoherent sum of all the particles in their image, and then measure the CTF rings from that. The problem when you're shooting to CCD and you don't have a huge amount of real estate and you maybe have a fairly low distribution of particles is that incoherent sum does not give you too much signal at all. And I think that's maybe a little different with film. When you have 10 times the real estate, you can start to build up, this is like a set of 2,000 particles, you can start to build up that power spectrum and you can start to see the CTF minima. So this is maybe a particular problem with shooting, imaging to CCDs, and it's one that the single particle packages don't address particularly well at the moment because they are used to dealing with, you know, maybe 50 films, and we're now starting to deal with 2,000 or 3,000 images instead. So it's something we have to take into account. So our approach actually has just been to measure the defocus from the focus image that we acquire at the low dose position, where it's very, very obvious where those rings are. You may well wonder what the difference in defocus between the exposure one image and the focus setting is. And in fact, we've done some measurements on that. We can determine the focus very accurately from these. And occasionally, if we're lucky, we can determine the defocus from the exposure one image. So we've measured the difference. And the results are a little bit flaky because they're 200 nanometers plus or minus 300 nanometers. So the standard deviation is high. mostly because it's really hard to do it accurately from these exposure images because the defocus ring is very weak. But to, you know, the conclusion from that was it's not that bad. I mean, basically, they're very close in focus, but this is something we intend to do more work on. Okay, so what you really want to do is completely automatically determine this defocus setting. You don't want to have to sit there and tweak, you know, curves and try fits and do all of this, because you may have, as I say, thousands of images, and doing that image by image is a real pain. So we want to be able to do that as automatically as possible. For these kinds of images, it's fairly straightforward. I mean, basically, you're looking for minima in these curves, you do some background subtraction, and they show up very, very well. It gets harder if there's actual structure in your image at low frequencies, because then you might find a minima that's due to the structure of the particle as opposed to the CTF curve. So to make this completely bulletproof automated is still a bit of a challenge, and we get it right maybe 90% of the time. And 10% of the time we don't. So we have these kinds of interactive tools to flick through the images and just check them and throw out the ones that don't work. But we hope in the end we won't have to do that at all, and we'll have more bulletproof methods for doing the defocus measurement automatically. I think the helical processing people would have noticed in their CTF determination, they see nothing, basically. They don't see these nice minima in the CTF. This is actually from a helical example, but it's one of the best ones I ever looked at. Basically, what we do is we'll walk along the helix, taking and randomly rotate that little bit of protein that we have, and then make an incoherent sum of that, and we get something like this power spectrum. If we take a straight line through it, we get that curve, and we do some background subtraction, we can pull these off very nicely. That's what happens in theory. In practice, you usually can't see any of these rings at all, and it's a real challenge, and you may be much better off going and measuring that defocus from a focus image or a piece of measuring carbon, which is what a lot of people do. Okay, so that's our approach. It's fairly simple and as automated as possible. There's, of course, lots of literature about automatic CTF correction. Plenty of people are writing papers on this and thinking about it. Just a few of them, and I say a few because I've probably missed, you know, some favorite person's reference out, so don't take this as a comprehensive list, but if you go to the very latest papers, they'll refer to all of the ones in the past, and you can track through the literature that way. Okay, so that was CTF correction. So assume you know how to correct your CTF, now you've got to pick out your particles, and you want to, again, do this automated. There's no way in the world, if we start doing 100,000 particle data sets, that anybody, you know, is going to be able to pick them one by one. And even as I think several people mentioned in the talk, even screening 100,000 particles is a giant pain. And as you go close to focus and you look at more noisy images, it might actually be quite tedious to screen them, because as a lot of people will tell you, it's a lot easier to spot a particle in context in an image than it is once it's boxed out. Because once it's boxed out, somehow your eye doesn't do as good a job of saying is it a particle or not. So this whole screening problem should go away. I'll tell you a little bit about our approach to doing automated particle selection and then tell you about where that's going. So Yongchen Zhu in our group comes from the vision community, and when he arrived, we were concentrating on the problem of automatically reconstructing TMV, and Yongchen decided to use an edge detection algorithm combined with Hutch transforms and some intelligent grouping and organization to pick out these TMV particles. And that works very well with these kinds of structures. Yongchen, again, will be doing demos on Thursday afternoon. He'll have his software app and images from the database. You can go and chat to him about that then. So as Clint mentioned, we take a far from focus image because it's a whole heck of a lot easier to see edges in that image, and we find the particles in there, and then we align the near-to-focus image to the far-from-focus image. We know exactly how this one is shifted relative to that, and then by knowing these, we can just strip them out of the near-to-focus image. It may look fairly obvious in this particular example. In some of them, those filaments are virtually invisible, and it would be very, very difficult to do it by eye. A bit of both. Sometimes we just shoot blind, and other times we actually know there's particles there. As Clint was talking about earlier, we do target determination. We can actually find targets in those holes. So sometimes we are actually finding targets. In this particular experiment, I think we were shooting blind because we knew there was TMB everywhere. So if you can take out the targeting step, that's good because you save time. So if it's protein everywhere, just shoot blind and just raster across, you know, holes or whatever. If something like microtubules, where you get one or two per hole, you cannot do that. You must know when you acquire that image that you're acquiring a good image. So it varies. Okay, so we can strip the filaments. Sorry. It's small, you know, it's like 10 seconds, 20 seconds or something to do your filament finding, or less, I don't know. It's actually fast, but still, you know, if you can live without it, we live without it. I can't quite remember, we've got all these timings stored somewhere in the database. But it's not minutes and minutes, in other words, but it's another increment. You know? Everything you do costs you, right? You focus, you drip check, you target find, every single thing is costing you and adding up to, you know, accumulate. Time. You want to get that as efficient as possible, you cut out as many steps as possible. Okay, so this works extremely well for filaments. It also works, this edge finding method works very well on large particles that are very easy to spot, like these hemocyanins. So these are like little filaments, if you like. And Yongchen develops a very nice, clever rectangular Huff transform, so we can tell the circular particles from the rectangulars, because it's only the rectangular ones we want in the reconstruction. These top-down views don't do us much good, right? All the information and then it's redundant. So we're really going after these guys. And so he had to have an algorithm that would sort them out. And basically he finds all the edges and then he uses a circular Huff transform to identify the circles and remove them. And then he uses a rectangular Huff transform to find the remaining rectangles. And again, that works very well on this kind of data. But, here's a couple of examples. In this particular experiment, we had 411 image pairs, and he pulled out 686 filaments. In this hemocyanin experiment, 815 image pairs, and there's 23,000 particles were automatically selected from that. So this kind of edge finding works quite well for us, but we knew that it wasn't going to work very well on very small, noisy single particles, you know, GROEL or worse. So we knew we had to look at other algorithms. So what we decided to do was have a workshop here, and invite all the people who were doing this that we could find in the world and get them to come and show us their algorithms and try and make a decision as to which one works best. And I'll talk more about this in the next couple of slides. But basically, what we did was we compared human-to-human selection. There was a whole group of algorithms that basically do template matching. They start with a rough model of the object and then they do cross-correlation and they pick them out. There were a whole class of algorithms that did feature recognition, like Yongchen's algorithm, doing edge detection. And then there was a new kind of algorithm from Satya Malik, who's here somewhere, I think. Satya, are you here in the audience? Nope, he's bailed today. He's a student in the course, and he's using a machine learning approach, and you probably saw the poster up on that. The problem with this, of course, is that everybody gets a different answer. Even a human versus another human will disagree about whether something is a particle or not. Some people will pick one and some people will pick the other. So we actually organized this in terms of a bake-off. We decided we would collect all these results together and we would systematically compare them one against the other. And you can see this at the demo on Thursday afternoon, if you like, but I'll just illustrate it now to give you an idea of what it does. Jenny Feldman, as part of the database, wrote this really nice piece of software which seems to hang, my machine seems to be hanging at the moment. I'm giving it a bit too much to do, I think. Hold on a second. There we go. Just struggling too hard. So you can go to this web address that I've listed there and you can see the results of this entire bake-off. For instance, you can select Moose, who was a human, and you can compare him against Hart, who is another human selection, and then the red circles show the one human selection, and the green dots, which are not showing up, I really apologize for this. That's the problem with doing a demo like this. Sometimes they fail. Hold on a sec. Let's see if we can get it to boot into life. No, for some reason, it's just not showing the cross comparison. So you're now going to have to go to that demo so you can see it, because it's kind of cool. Yeah, the whole thing is not actually refreshing at the moment. But basically you can pick any one and you'll get a red circle, and you pick the opposite one and get a green dot, and then you can see physically, you know, what somebody did, and you can start to have a discussion. Why did this person pick one and the other person didn't pick them? So the conclusion from this workshop, it was actually a very interesting workshop, and we had quite a few people come. But one of the hardest things to do is know when you're right. I mean, so you have this automated particle picking algorithm, but how do you know what the truth set is? How do you know who's right? Because humans aren't necessarily the best judge of this. I mean, a human being looking at a particle that's maybe this shape will pick lots of these and almost none of these, because it just don't see them. Whereas an algorithm might do quite a good job of finding those, because it's not biased, and it will just go hunt them down with a cross-correlation technique, the same as everything. So what Yongshen did is compare each algorithm, every single algorithm, against every single other algorithm, and score them in terms of what we call a false positive, when the comparison algorithm picks something and the other algorithm didn't, and a false negative, which is the other way around. So you can score all these algorithms and put them into a table, and this was sort of the result. That was the bake-off result that we came up with. And again, this is on a poster somewhere, and it's soon going to appear in a paper in JSB, and it shows the results of this, and there's some discussion as to, you know, which algorithm is better based on that scoring criteria. So what we concluded from this is that there's plenty of good algorithms out there, and maybe all of them are sort of okay. But it seems like Alan Roseman's algorithm, which has been adopted by a bunch of people, seems like a good bet as a template matching algorithm. The other one we're very interested in is Satya Malik's algorithm, which we think will have some real potential as well. So those are the two that we're going to pursue. Yongshen is actually, this plus means Yongshen's added a few things to this algorithm to improve its characteristics in certain circumstances. Maybe he'll tell you about that. He's writing that work up at the moment. So here's some example of using that Roseman algorithm on some of our images. It works pretty well for GROW-EL. I mean, you'd have to study these, you know, sort of semi-intensely to decide whether it did a good job or not, but it basically picked up 23,000 particles from the GROW-EL image, and they seem to be good. Now, Andrea Manuel, who's at this course too, has a huge ribosome particle data set, which she hand-picked all her particles. So she did human selection on all 26,000, and then Yongshen applied this Roseman plus algorithm to them. So we have a very nice comparison in that case again. We can start to do some systematic studies now and decide how well did the algorithm do against at least a human being. And one of the ways Andrea and Yongshen are proposing to do that is to simply do the reconstructions from these two different sets and see which reconstruction is best, because perhaps that's the best decision, the best criterion to use for which is the best algorithm. Not whether you like what it picked, but does it get a better result? Is the resolution better? Is there a better distribution of angles, for instance? Do people, in fact, bias against particular views, which they well might? And those kinds of questions can now be asked when you can do these huge studies. And again, it does a fairly good job of doing CPMV, you know, 14,000 particles in 6 hours or something. These timings, I'll say more about timings in a bit. Okay, so you've assessed your images, corrected the CTF, or at least measured the defocus, and you've selected out the particles, and now you want to do the reconstruction. Well, as you'll notice here, there's six different practical groups, right, studying six different reconstruction algorithms. There's no one package in this field, sadly. And maybe, okay, that's a whole other thing for the panel. We'll leave that alone right now. But so our approach has been to, you know, basically try and integrate the existing packages out there with our automated approach. So we're not trying to rewrite yet another package. That's probably the last thing the field needs. But what we do is integrate our existing helical package with Legendon, integrate both EMAN and SPIDER with Legendon to do single particle reconstruction, and integrate Tim Baker's virus reconstruction package in. So we're trying to glom those packages on to our automated collection and keep track of things in the database. So what I'll do is really just work through a couple of examples there. So a few years ago, I guess, a couple of years ago maybe, we decided that we were going to do this automation task, and we really believed in this grid-to-map idea. So we set ourselves the task of reconstructing a map of TMV to 10 angstroms within 24 hours of inserting the specimen in stage with no intervention required by any operator. That means nobody was making any decisions as to what images went in, nobody's hand selecting anything, nobody's making a decision at all. We set it as a sort of a goal to show that this kind of thing is possible. And this is really the result. There's the 10 angstrom map. These are some of the background images. And since we already went through, you know, the steps that we went, that we did in Legendon to acquire those images, and I explained how we did the particle selection, you might ask, why TMB? Why did we choose TMB? Well, we knew we needed something well-known to do this test on. New ways of doing things aren't always popular and come into a lot of criticism. The last thing we wanted to do this on was some unknown structure where we'd get into an argument about the structure. We wanted something where everybody knows the structure and everybody's going to agree if we get the right answer or not. So TMB is, you know, everybody's favorite EM specimen. It's indestructible. You can get lots of it. You can leave it lying on a shelf for years and it still works well as a nice standard. The interesting thing about the basic subunit, though, is it has these nice four alpha helices here. So they provide a lovely little signature for whether you can see alpha helices or not in the structure. So we wanted something that would have an obvious structure like that so we could see it at 10 angstroms. And as has already been explained, it provides you a little ruler. It has layer lines of very nice spacing at 69, 23 is a nice big strong one, 11.5 is a nice big strong one, 9 is weaker at 7.6, and then there's theoretically another strongish one at 5.8. So to the extent that we would be able to see these layer lines, either in the raw images or in an average, it told us exactly what resolution we were getting out of the system. And, you know, at the time we started doing this, there was this huge argument anyway about whether can you even use a CCD camera to image single particles, you know, are the CCD cameras good enough, and all of those arguments. And so here's some real data. This is a single filament of TMV, and I think you can see that 11.5 angstrom layer line very nicely, very strong. You can sometimes, on very good ones, see the 9.8 as well. If you have a whole raft of them, so you're doing some averaging sort of on the fly, if you like, in your image, you can certainly see the 7.6 angstrom layer line on the CCD. And this was just Lab 6 data obtained when we were still in Illinois. So this is not, you know, using a FEG or anything else to boost those high order amplitudes. So we were fairly sure we could maybe acquire data out to 7.6 angstroms using our CCD. So then we went through the usual process, right, finding the filaments, in the near-to-focus, stripping it out, far-from-focus, stripping it out of the near-to-focus, or vice versa, I can't see here, getting the filaments, taking the power spectra, and then going through the whole helical processing thing. And in the next 52 slides, I'm going to go through that in detail. Not really. It's just, you can talk to the people in the helical group probably doing a great post on this. We'll explain it in detail and very thoroughly. But the basic idea is that you find the power spectra of these, you find the layer lines, and you average a whole bunch of them together and build up signals and noise on each of those layer lines. Then you can take those layer lines and do a Fourier Bessel inversion to get your maps finally. So this is an example, a particular example. We've done this experiment several times now, showing what those layer lines look like and telling you why we believe we have roughly, certainly, we have about 10 angstrom data in it. And maybe we even believe that we have 7 angstrom data because we get a real signal on that layer line, a believable signal. The phase over Klopstone was too bad, so we can believe it. Just incidentally, the Fourier Shell correlation for this experiment came out at about 6. But that was done the way a lot of people, I think, do it. We did all the alignments, then we split the images in 2, and we did the Fourier Shell correlation. I mean, that's typically what's done, but we should probably do this again, starting from 2 completely separate paths. But so that sort of agrees with what we think we have in resolution in that image. But better than that, who cares about resolution? It's a completely, you know, arbitrary measure in some ways. What you care about is, can you interpret your map? I mean, can you see anything in this map that's useful at all? I think we get very obsessed with resolution, and we have to be careful that we have questions to answer, and they're not necessarily, you know, answered any better at 3 angstroms than they are at 10. So I think, you know, one thing we need to bear in mind and perhaps have a discussion on this is that the question you're asking determines the resolution, and this obsession with high resolution is not necessarily the thing we should be doing. Anyway, so if you look at the map of TMV, you take a cylindrical section at, I think, 66 angstroms from the central axis and unwrap that cylinder, what you see there are those four alpha helices that come from this position of the subunit. So, you know, why 10 angstroms? Why is our goal 10 angstroms? Because at 10 angstroms, you start to be able to see that kind of secondary structure, and you start to be able to fit these X-ray maps into complex structures and understand the macromolecular machine at some kind of high resolution. So that's what we set as a goal of most of what we do with this automation. Not 3 angstroms at the moment, but 7 to 12, say. Okay, that's in the, that's the sort of, you know, take-home message of this is, yes, you can do it in 24 hours, actually you can do it in 12 hours for TMD. It's a nice simple case. You know, this is for this particular experiment, we looked at one grid, 19 squares, 91 holes, et cetera, et cetera, you know, found a few hundred filaments, did this in 12 hours, and at the same time as this was going on, we could strip out the filaments and do the reconstruction. In the end, because you can judge the quality of every filament that goes into a reconstructed map, we threw out a lot that we determined weren't so good, and we only used 45 filaments in the final map. So that's about 70,000 particles, and the resolution is approximately 7.6 then. So we can certainly get to 7 angstrom resolution with 70,000 particles. The yield represented by this experiment, if you say that only 45 of the 243 was any good, is 20%. That means 80% of the data we acquired, we threw away. The layer lines were strong enough, they didn't fit into the map well enough, the tilt and shifts were too high. Something's wrong with the data, and that's an excellent question, why? And, you know, one of the things we'd like to do with this database and by able, you know, systematically looking at results like this is figure out why, you know, how come 80% of that data is bad? I think you heard, maybe it was David, discuss the results from Mamba's lab, where they only needed 40,000 copies of the macromolecule to get to atomic resolution. So why do we sometimes need a million copies? Perhaps because, you know, the other, what is it, 960,000 are no good. But if we could figure out which the no good ones are, we might be doing a lot better. So I think this is a, you know, definitely a quest for our particular group. Okay, so we don't only work on TMV. Sometimes I think our group thinks we only work on TMV, but we do a few other things. We set ourselves a kind of standard data set project. You know, we said we're going to do, for helical, we're going to do TMV. For single particles, we're going to do hemocyanin. We'll probably also do GROEL. Hemocyanin was sort of historically determined because our postdoc was studying that. So we did the hemocyanin project. Again, the same statistics here. It takes a lot longer to find single particles because they're not organized into these big arrays. So 21,000 particles took us 28 hours in this case. We used about 11,000 of them in the map, which actually represents 110,000 because of the symmetry of the particle. And the resolution of that map, well, I think this was done using SPIDA, right, is 12 angstroms if you use the 3 sigma criteria or 15 if you use the 0.5 criteria. So again, we'd like to understand this and explore it and try and get that resolution up to something we'd like. Okay, so somebody asked me earlier, can you only use Legendon in ice? Indeed not. We love to do stain. Stain is just so fun because you can get enormous amounts of data and they're so hassling with drift and filling quiet and all the rest of it. So we've done lots of experiments in stain. And this particular one was for cow P mosaic virus, which Jack Johnson's group is interested in. I think this data is from Wendy, who's attending the course. And this was the same grid. We only had to look at 4 grid squares, and then we just wrapped it across. There was tons of virus around. We just sort of stripped off images from the grid scale. Because it's stain, we could leave this running overnight. We just went home and left it running, and the next morning, you know, it had found 24,000 particles, which was perhaps a few more than we needed. But the system is fairly stable. I mean, we went out the door and came back, and it was still imaging, still focusing, still doing a good job, which is a good sign. This gives you some statistics on how long this kind of simple experiment takes. We can get about 100 images an hour, which maybe this kind of distribution represents a couple of thousand particles per hour. We can strip them off faster than that. We can strip them off at 3,800 particles an hour, so we can keep pace with this experiment. We're using another processor, and then we can probably get a map like this, which is 30 to 40 angstrom map, with a few hundred particles, and we can probably do that in far less than an hour. I'm not exactly sure what the statistics are on that. But certainly this whole process can keep pace. So we could get a map like that within half an hour to an hour of putting the grid in. So this means you could do a whole long systematic screening if you were trying to attach something to your CPMB. You could have many, many grids, and you could do each one in half an hour to an hour and get a map and have a decision rather than going through the painful process of doing it by hand. Okay, so what next? So that's basically what Legendon is set up to do, and of course we're going to go on with this and try and make it better. We're going to do more integration with all the packages. We're going to try and get that goal of the big green button on the screen sometime over the next 5 years. But what else are we looking at? I mean, the goal at the moment for the resource, the fundamental goal is to improve the throughput. You've heard a lot about CCDs and film and all the rest of it over the last week. Basically, the area of a CCD camera compared to film is heartbreakingly small. I think if I'd really understood that ratio when we started to get into this business, Clint and I, a few years ago, we would have quit right then. But luckily, we didn't think it through well enough. So we didn't realize that 1,000 by 1,000 CCD, was maybe 1/100th of the area that film's covering. Which means if you're going to use a 1K by 1K CCD and you expect to do better than film, you're going to have to be 100 times more efficient at everything you do in order to do that well. So this is a kind of a really heartbreaking statistic. Everything has to be very fast. Well, it's getting better. We're going to 2Ks and 4Ks. But actually, there's other ways you can improve throughput, too, and I'm just going to discuss three of them. One of them is just better data acquisition and targeting algorithms, doing these things faster, acquiring the images faster. If it's cryo stages were more stable, that would help because they drift a lot. And we can talk about that a lot, but I thought we didn't have time to talk about it here. And then CCD cameras should get better, and I'll have a few slides on that. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about yield, and then a little bit about sustainability. Okay, so the 2K camera, I think this is more or less accurate. It's doing this in a hurry, but I think that round circle more or less represents the area that you're going to get on your 2K CCD camera if you take your mag up to 60,000 or so, which is where we typically acquire images. So that means if you acquire 4 images, which we do in the TMG experiments, you're covering a fair amount of the real estate. Remember that on a piece of film, you get this entire thing at the resolution you want, just by grabbing a piece of film. So if we acquire 4 of them, we're getting close to where we can sort of compete in efficiency with film. Oh, by the way, we shoot these 4 like this because if we do it like this, the edge of the beam touches the carbon, and that seems to reduce the charging. If you shot one in the middle where the beam was not touching the carbon at all, we seem to get a lot of charging. We know that because we've done these systematic studies where we varied, the size of the beam touching the carbon versus not touching, and you see those 11.5 layer lines in those TMV rocks miraculously disappear in a heartbeat. So that's another systematic way you can assess an imaging protocol like that. So if we go to 4K cameras, which we have in this lab, we now have a 4K Gatan on the robot Tech 9, and we're getting a 4K Teats camera on the other Tech 9. So we'll have both varieties, and that will be nice because we'll be able to compare them. So now this yellow square is the 2K, and this red square is the 4K. And if we acquire 4K, we basically can get the same real estate as film. And then we hope we can get much more efficient at doing this digitally than we can in film. Question? Okay, so that's going to make a big difference in our lives. So instead of getting those 23,000 particles of GROEL, now you're getting 100,000 particles of GROEL in a single experiment. Now, of course, that all just depends on what the real resolution of the camera is and MTFs and on and on and on. I think we're going to measure all that. We're also going to do this empirically. We're going to just get the data, and we're going to do the reconstructions, and we're going to see whether we can get the results that we want. We're going to do this for TMV, for GROEL, and for some viruses, and we're just going to see how well they perform and how fast we can acquire the data. But we see that the goal of 100,000 particles in a day, in a 12 to 24-hour day, is very achievable now with 4K. So the other thing we really need to think carefully about, though, is yield. I mean, this is an example of one of our TMV experiments where we looked at, whatever it says there, I can't read it from this angle, 16 squares, and we looked at 90 holes, and we found 66 filaments and, identified layer lines, and then rejected them for one reason or another. The layer lines weren't strong enough. They didn't fit well enough into the map. or all the rest of it. So in the end, only 20 of these squares, of all the ones we looked at, and we looked at, what does that say? I can't see it. Oh, you can't see it. 167. We looked at 167 squares, but only 20 of them actually ended up contributing filaments to the final mat. For one reason or another, all the rest got thrown out. So that's a fairly low yield, and if we could improve that, this 12-hour experiment suddenly goes to a 1-hour experiment. We knew where to find the good data, we'd be done in an hour and we could move on to the next experiment. Or better than that, we'd have many, many more good filaments in the mat and we'd get to a higher resolution. So studying this yield and figuring out what makes a good filament versus a bad filament, I think is critical. And that's why the database that we have implemented is so important to, you know, that overall goal, because now we can start to search and mine that database and figure out, well, where did they come from? You know, one of the obvious questions we asked was, oh, are those good grid squares all in one place? No, they're not. They're scattered all over the grid. You know, did they all come from one time of the day? No, unfortunately not. There are some things we think do classify them, and that's what we're going to explore. We have had the ability to do that for a while, but we haven't had enough data. But now, you know, we have this terabyte of data that we can explore, and some huge systematic experiments, we're going to start asking those kinds of questions. Okay, improving sustainability. I think Clint mentioned, you know, these experiments run 20 to 30 hours on the big runs like Groviel. And if you're insane, you go home and come in the next day and everything's happy. If you're doing ice, there has to be a human being in that command console all night long with an alarm clock that wakes up every hour and a half and goes and fills up the cryostat. It's very tedious and quite stressful on our group. That's why we run one experiment a week. Because somebody has to stay all night and there have to be shifts and people have to come and relieve each other and all the rest of it. And by, you know, a day and a half of that, you're fed up and you don't want to do it again for a few days. But if we could not have to have anybody stay, we could set up and, you know, walk out the room at 5 o'clock and come in the next day, we could probably run an experiment every day. And hopefully when we have both techniques, 2 experiments a day, and then we've got 10 experiments a week. That's maybe we need more disk in that case. So one of the critical missions then is to try and figure out a way of automatically filling this cryostat. And luckily in our group we have Jim and Denny Salmon, Jim Polokas and Denny Salmon, who are engineers by training, and they decided that they could build a system to auto-fill the cryostat. And this shows a little movie of that we made some time ago, actually. And this shows a little control interface, and, you know, there's a little red light that says, okay, I'm going to fill. And then it drives liquid nitrogen very, very slowly so that it drips slowly into the cryostat. It's important to do this very slowly because I think if you did your cryo training, if you douse a big gush of liquid nitrogen into a cryo stage, you'll start the thing boiling and you'll see the surface shimmer and shimmer. And then you have to plunge that silly, you know, glass tube in and blow some nitrogen off and then check, you know, did it stop and all the rest of it. Well, you could try and do that with a robotic system, but that's kind of a pain. It's not a very controlled way to do it. So what we'd prefer to do is do it slow enough that we don't start the darn thing boiling. And it seems to be that with this nice slow percolation device that they've built, we can indeed do that. We can drip it in slowly enough. And we're going to be doing quite a big effort on that over the next few months and hoping to develop a system that will be available generally. Scott? Well, you wouldn't acquire while you drip. They'd say, okay, I need to fill just as you do now. Exactly. You know, you don't... No. You could see that whole timing interface which will be integrated with Legendon. We'll say, okay, in fact, one of the things we're missing in this system is a way to measure the height of the liquid nitrogen. We could do it simply by time, say, okay, every half an hour we're going to drip for this long and we know that, you know, that's so much volume and therefore we can control it. What we'd prefer is a way to measure the height of the liquid nitrogen. We've done some other studies that show if you keep that level of liquid nitrogen constant, you get very little drift. You let that drop up and down through the doer, and the whole thing starts drifting. So there's, you know, more than one reason for having this kind of system where you can really control that level very, very precisely. Okay, and then you've probably all seen the big robot that's in Techno 1. And that's the other demo that will be going on tomorrow afternoon. Christian will be showing the robot loading up a grid. It's really fun. You should see it. Gives you a bad turn as you see this thing flung past the microscope every time. But so far it hasn't hit it. So just saying, why are we building this robotic system? It's not for cryo, that's for sure. I mean, a robotic system is good for something where you want to do tens of grids a day. You know, it's going to do it automatically. Cryo, you tend to do one. Now, we more might like a robot to load that grid for us, but, you know, it's an expensive way of getting out of 10 minutes' work. Whereas if you're doing tens of grids or hundreds of grids over a weekend, it's really expensive to keep a person around when all they have to do is load the grid. So that was our philosophy. We wanted to develop this robotic system, but we had a certain goal in mind. And the goals we had were, there's several of them, and we're adding to this list rapidly now that we have the system, but one of which is screening trials. You heard Andrew talk about 50 grids he has to do, and that's a small trial, and it's small because it's a pain to do. He'd probably want to do 100 grids if it was easy to do and he could do it overnight or over the weekend. The kind of virus characterizations that I showed you for CPMB, where you're trying to attach something to your virus and you have lots and lots of different chemistries that you're trying to study all at once. Those kinds of experiments are the things we're thinking about doing with our robotic system. So this is how it's set up. It has a tray of 96 grids available to it. This is built on the same dimensions as a microtiter plate in X-ray crystallography world. We have high hopes of back-ending this up in the end, that there'll be a robot automatically making grids and loading them into the tray, and people won't have to handle the grids at all, which means they'll be in much better shape because people mangle grids badly, as you know. So the robot then picks up the grid from the tray and loads it into the end of the specimen rod and then closes the flap on the specimen rod and then picks up the holder and sticks it into the microscope. And I think this is a little video made just a couple of weeks ago showing some of those steps. And you should really go and see this live on Thursday because it's a heck of a lot more fun when the motor is whirring and the thing is really moving these grids around. It's also pretty remarkable, I think, that this robot, this huge, big, heavy arm, has this very fine tweezer at the end and can really handle a grid pretty effectively. When Clint came up with this idea of doing robotic grid loading a few years ago, I think most people thought you couldn't handle a grid. Grid's too flimsy. You know, it's hard enough for people to try and pick up that grid, and you know, it doesn't have enough mass to handle effectively and all the rest of it. But in fact, robotic technology is astoundingly sophisticated, and it's a huge technology. It's used in semiconductor industry and building watches and making cars and all the rest of it. And it's actually a fairly affordable technology compared to the price of an electron microscope. Anyway. So there it goes through its whole cycle. It's integrated with Lesinon now. So basically Lesinon says, hey, I'd like a grid in the scope. And the robot software turns on, puts the grid in. When it gets to the stage of putting it into the airlock, it asks Lesinon, when can I, you know, do the rotation, is vacuum okay, it gets that signal, puts it in, etc., etc. So the whole thing is kind of integrated into Lesinon and now allows us to do these large screening trials because we can do tens of grids. Right, well, that's, you know, what Clint was talking about earlier. I mean, you know, but there's two approaches to do this. Okay, why is it on a Techni thing? The minute API wants to give us a T12 to develop this on, we'll be very happy. But in fact, that Techni is an arrangement with API for us to do development on. We're very happy to have it, but it's the one machine where we can throw a huge robot into the room, and you know, the other machines are jointly owned in this facility, and I'm guessing Ron and Francisco and some others might have objected had we installed an enormous robot in the middle of their room. But that one is a development machine. It's the one we get to try these sorts of things out on. When it works, and we hope it will work and you know prove its worth, it would be obvious to put it on a T12 or something simple like that. So that's a good question. And the other question was what? Okay, so indeed, we can develop a targeting algorithm for lots of things. I mean, if they're good crystals like catalase or they have sharp edges or things like that, we can presumably find them. But one of the approaches for crystals that are maybe every single one is different is the robot can accurately replace the grid into the same spot, you know, to within an error that we can correct for. So the idea would be overnight, it'll look at, get all its atlases and, you know, pictures of the squares and, you know, do all of those grids overnight. And then the next day, the person will come in and look at the database and say, oh, I'd like a high mag image here and here and here and here, and flick through the database, choosing targets. And then the next night, the robot will go back through and pick those targets. We'd have either approach. If the crystals are easy to find and easily targeted, we can do that in one step. If they're not and they're very messy, then we might have to do this two-step approach. Yes. Exactly. It handles it, you know, by the edges, and it doesn't move much from one to the other. I mean, it moves a little bit, but, you know, we can correct for a little bit. We can correct for the rotation and translation because we know it's more or less in the same orientation. Kristen's laughing because we don't know this for sure yet, but I'm very sure. I'm very sure we will be able to find the same place because it's not going to rotate it like this. You know, it may move a little bit, but there's an enormous raster that we can cross-correlate on to get it back into the same spot, in theory. And those are measurements we need to do. I mean, the whole robot's only been in for a couple of weeks, so there's still lots of measurements to be done. So, you know, back to those examples, why would you do this? Screening trials. We did one of these screening trials by hand without the robot for Yoshi Fujiyoshi a while ago. He basically really wants to examine every single grid square on the grid and take an image of it and see whether he has crystals. And this is standard Legendon stuff, right? I mean, you know, getting the grid square, finding the crystals, taking a high mag image, and then you can even find spots in this image and say, how well does this thing diffract? But basically, they don't even want to know how well. They just want to know, does it diffract at all? Are they, in fact, making crystals? So these are the kinds of questions that are maybe relatively straightforward to answer. Again, the CPMV experiment, we know we can do thousands of particles an hour, so basically in an hour we can get a map, so we could do, you know, many, many of these maps overnight or over a weekend. And we also think, you know, this kind of just straightforward classification, you know, how big are the particles you find, you know, or how many empty ones versus full ones, these kinds of questions, not only for virus classification, but for other classification schemes as well, will be interesting and useful to answer in this very automated way. I mean, basically, once you can look at 100 grids versus 10, you can start to ask all kinds of different questions that you wouldn't have been able to face if some, you know, some mechanized system wasn't doing the work for you. Okay, so that's a lot of the projects I described are basically being done under the auspices of our National Resource for Automated Molecular Microscopy. This resource is an NCRR-funded resource from NIH, and we opened our doors, I think, December 1 last year. So all those core technology projects, handling the specimens, Legendon, acquiring the images, doing the automated processing, and developing the big database, are all core technology development projects under that resource. Our sort of overall goals are to be able to, in a routine fashion, get 7 to 15 angstroms resolution in high throughput, and to make this accessible to the mainstream community, to make it so that anybody who has a biological problem can come ask that question and get their map, and you don't have to go through a 9-day training course in order to do that. So that's the sort of long-term 5-year goal of the resource. We do collaborative and service projects. That means if you have a project and you want to come and acquire data at the resource, you can apply and, you know, we can accept the project and then we'll acquire the data and at least acquire the data and get that back to you and maybe sometimes process it as well. One of the other things that the national resources are supposed to do is train and disseminate, and that's why we're having this course. So the course was proposed in the original proposal, and we agreed that we would have it basically every 2 years. So that's what this is all about, and it's NCRR who's funding quite a lot of it. So that's our team. NRAM is sort of the big resource, and then our group is called the Automated Molecular Imaging Group. Jim Poulopis is Mr. Legendon, wrote the software and designed a lot of it, and we'll demonstrate that tomorrow afternoon. Denny did the database and does a lot of the other engineering projects, and he'll demonstrate the database tomorrow afternoon. Christian is helping very much with building LegendOn at this stage and does all the machine interface between the software and the tech knives and the CCDs, and is also in charge of the robot project. Yonchen Zhu does the particle segmentation and selection, and he'll be also showing his stuff off tomorrow afternoon. Francisco does a lot of our processing. Many of you know him. He's been teaching in the E-Man course, which is remarkable because I think he only joined the group like 6 months ago or something, and he's now become good enough that he's actually used as a teacher in the E-Man course, and he comes not from this field at all. Joel has golden hands and can make great grids and get them in the scope and have them perfectly positioned, and has become a real expert at using LegendOn and you know, acquiring these huge data sets. Angie Cheng is part-time with our group and part-time with Mark Yeager's group, and she's been doing a lot of the driving for developing LegendOn. And she seems to have this wonderful ability to drive our software engineers into 24-hour solid work in the most pleasant way possible, yeah, without seeming like she's nagging. This guy, who you notice all these guys are trapped to their desks and in front of computers, and he's on a boat. That's because he's not in the group yet, but he will be in December. And then we'll see if we don't change that background somewhat. Brian, I think you all know, is you know magical at everything and can keep the entire mesh running and these terabytes of data streaming in and out, and we never know anything about it. I think the worst thing about a system manager is that the only time you know they exist is when things go wrong. You know, if nothing's going wrong, you don't even know they're doing anything. And Cynthia Lacar has organized this entire workshop, the first time she's ever done it, first time we've ever done it, and I think it's just done an amazing job of keeping everything running on track. And then there's Clint and I, who probably do nothing useful anymore except administrate. And I think that's about it. Question back in? A lot. And that's something we want to be very systematic about. I mean, one of the things though we need in order to be able to make those assessments is a very accurate measure of the aspectness. And so that's one of the projects that we're hoping to pursue. It's hard to do all of these systematic studies because they take a lot of time and energy and effort, and the resource only goes so far. You know, it's handling a lot of projects. So we're actually trying for more funding to do those kinds of large systematic studies to say, you know, what makes a good image versus a bad image. And I think this, Nigel, I think, has told us he thinks that's terribly critical. You know, too thick is no good, too thin is no good. There's something that's just right. And maybe that's not only to do with the imaging, but the freezing conditions. You know, maybe it freezes just right when the ice is exactly the right thickness. You know, there's a lot of little, you know, micro mechanics going on when you freeze that we don't understand well at all. There's another question there? Yeah. Yeah, it's expensive. You know, we've got to get funding to do it. I mean, I think you're right. The thing is, how do you make that case, you know, to a granting agency? You know, the students hate putting those goods in. Could he please have, you know, $100,000 to build a robot? Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's not fun. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the company that's developing this, helping us develop the negative scan has certainly thinking about that. And I think if they thought there was a market for it, we'd go ahead and try and build it. We don't actually have the resources to take that project on at the moment, but they might.
Your technology project, the specimen handling and automated imaging acquisition, appear as though you really have to have a facility for that. But for the automated processing and portions of the information handling, it would be quite generic for much smaller facilities than this. Would you be exploiting those?
Actually, the whole of it will be exportable and disseminated. And it's not true that the acquisition, you need a facility like this. I mean, that acquisition has already been sent up to David Agard's lab and is running there and will shortly be sent to many other labs who've applied for it. So we are hoping to make it a package that can be gotten running in lots of other labs. It doesn't necessarily need high-end microscopes or anything like that. You know, it just needs some careful management of the software and some good development on our end to make it approachable and accessible.
Yes.
Answer is yes. Everything we do is essentially made available to the academic community. Pardon. I'm not quite sure which slide you mean, but we certainly have big montages, you know, big grid atlases of stain and ice. I mean, they're very variable. You know, sometimes you get a fantastic, actually, I think one of Angie's atlases was maybe shown, and she had a beautiful grid that was very uniform right across the grid. I think you're also working on carbon, not over holy quantiles, so that was a very stable, solid grid. And I think that is an ice grid, but they vary tremendously. Yeah. Well, let me just answer the first one. I think you're right. I mean, these are the core technology projects we're working on at the moment. One of the things we really want to work on is specimen prep. You know, I mean, a lot of the time our bottleneck is not the data acquisition anymore because we can do that cost, but getting a good grid in the first place is a tremendously difficult task, and I think the VictorBot is going to help enormously with that because we can control many, many things with it. You know, so we at least cut out half the variables. Then, you know, we can start to look at different temperature and humidity and blotting and on and on and on. You know, we can do that once we've controlled at least the blotting time and force and all of those things. So we need to spend a lot of time on that, and we'll probably try and involve some inorganic chemists and material scientists, because I think some of those answers, you know, are coming to do with that very small chemistry on the surface of the grid. The lab six versus the fig. You know, you can get a 10 angstrom map out of a lab 6, and we have. I mean, our very first one, you know, was a lab 6. I don't think you can get a 7 angstrom map easily out of a lab 6, and you can easily get it out of a FEG. And things like measuring defocus are really, really hard on a lab 6 and really, really easy on a FEG. So, you know, I mean, you can get good data out of a lab 6. I wouldn't say, you know, it's a bad instrument. I think Andrew has his best data of his lab 6, in fact. But, you know, the things are certainly nice. If you can afford one, you get a fake. There's no question. Yeah. But I'm not the right person to ask that question to. So. No, I mean, that's because I know what TMB looks like, so I built that into the algorithm. I mean, if you do the Felix helical processing course, basically if you know the indexing, you know, it's built in as a parameter deck, and you know, once that's built in, then the whole thing is completely automated. But if it had never been indexed, then it wouldn't have been possible to do it without some kind of pre-processing. You know, the idea with automation, in the end, we hope to automate everything, and the big green go button. But for the moment, I mean, what you probably want to automate is when you've looked at a few of your particles, but now you want 100,000 or a million. So you know something about it, so you can define the parameters, you know, well. Or in Ron's case, you know, he knows what microtubules look like, but now he wants to look at 100 newtons of them. You know, and say, if you mutate this, what does it look like? If you change this condition, what does it look like? So it's the sort of thing where you've done the first experiment, and that's been exciting and fun, and you've figured out all the details. But now you have to do it 100 more times. And this is the kind of thing people do so badly, you know, because it's so boring. I mean, it's much easier to have a machine do something that needs to be done 100 times than a person, because the incentive to do it goes down dramatically. So that's the sort of thing it's useful for. And then you can build the parameters or build the, you know, the information into the automated system. Christian has that thing so cowed, you know. There's a whole lot of safety features built into it, obviously, one of which is the force sensor. So if it encounters unusual force, it'll stop and battle. You know, there's several other things. I mean, you'll notice that, actually, I think the company that did it did a very nice design on the system because it's actually fairly compact and doesn't really come near anybody. We were, at first, you're worried about this huge arm, you know, swinging through the room, but it doesn't. I mean, it's got a very neat path between the specimen stage and the grid, and you'd have to go to some amount of effort, you know, to get in its way. Not to say people won't, but as a result, it has this force sensor. So, you know, and that force sensor is actually very delicate because what you want to make sure is if it's trying to put the grid in and, you know, the column isn't where it expects it to be, that it's going to stop and, you know, retract and wait for some help. Yeah. Yeah. It actually moves extremely slowly at the moment, and we may in the end speed it up, but we decided to err on the side of caution, because even with a force sensor, of course, if you're going really fast, you know, it takes a while for a force sensor to click in. It might be right through you by it. But I don't think we feel terribly endangered by it. I'm sorry, Christian, I can't do that. any others? It actually picks it up, you know, this is a grid, it sort of scoops it up, if you like. So there's a tolerance on that. It's not, you know, in other words, going in this direction. It's scooping it, so there's a little bit of tolerance in the side. And, you know, again, we have to do the experiments. I mean, certainly we've seen it drop a grid, but I think since Christian's, you know, been doing experiments for the last few weeks, it hasn't dropped one. You know, how often, what the drop rate will be, and, you know, if somebody's got a badly mangled grid and things like that, we don't know yet. But it's not too bad. I mean, it's not as bad as you might think. It's certainly not picking it up like that. In that case, you'd be in trouble. It's just like a little scooper system. But you should probably do them both. And don't forget to do them for your practicals from yesterday and make sure to say which group you're in.
We did get that.
Oh, we did? Oh, sorry.
We'll take bridges. If you don't want to have any bridges, I'll take
them. And inspect everyone.
Okay, so give us questions for the panel tomorrow. And
thanks.
Practical start.